Welcome, friends, to The Hero Beside Me, the podcast that seeks to explore the professional and private lives of working dogs of all kinds. For thousands of years, humans and canines have shared a special bond and an essential partnership, which continues to grow in importance in our society today. Dogs are helping humans in a myriad of ways, performing essential tasks that only they can perform. The more we learn about them, the more endless their potential seems to be. It is my goal to document the way these amazing animals are making an indelible mark on our world with their astonishing abilities, incredible drive, insatiable zest for life, and unconditional love, which they generously bestow upon their humans. Join me as I explore the wonder of these canine heroes beside us. Listeners, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to bring you today's episode because it will be very educational to many on some very important issues that affect all of us. If I hadn't been introduced to today's guest, I don't know if I would have ever learned about the crucial work that canines and humans are doing in his field of expertise. Now that I've learned about it, I'm honored to pass on the knowledge to you, and I hope that you will do the same and pass it on to the people in your world. But before I introduce you to him, allow me to preface this interview with some thoughts. Friends, I am someone who happens to absolutely relish being in the outdoors. I live in coastal Southern California, where it's sunny and 70 degrees almost always, an irresistible combination. But beyond being outside in general, going for walks and hikes in my city, eating at outdoor restaurants and enjoying the beach, I also love camping and backpacking and going on hikes in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by nothing but nature. As far away from a screen as you can get. I love having an unobstructed view of the stars at night, walking along flowing streams and breathing in crisp mountain air. Going on camping trips to national parks is one of my most cherished pastimes, as is hiking on public lands with my dog. If you share these passions with me, then this episode is for you. Maybe you're listening to this and thinking that camping and hiking sound like the last activities on earth that you'd ever want to do. But you're listening to this podcast, which is all about dogs, which means in all likelihood, you're a dog lover. And if that's the case, then you're probably an animal lover in general. I'd be willing to bet that if you're an animal lover, then you would be incensed if I told you that much of our wildlife, I'm talking about squirrels and rabbits, and also bears, mountain lions, golden eagles, and the list goes on, are routinely poisoned in large numbers on our public lands. If you live in California like myself, and you've had it drilled into you how important it is to conserve water, because we have had some serious droughts in recent years, how angry would you be to learn that millions of gallons of our water are stolen every year to line the pockets of violent criminals? What is she going on about, you're probably thinking to yourself right about now? Listeners, what I'm talking about is the situation we find ourselves in as Americans today. In a war for our environment, our wildlife, and our water. That most of us didn't even know we were fighting. My guest today is John Norris, who served 26 years as a warden for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and co-developed and led his agency's Elite Tactical Unit and Sniper Unit, which were developed to combat the most environmentally damaging criminals working within California and impacting the nation. He's going to tell us all about those criminals, what they're up to, why it matters, how dogs are integral to the fight against them, and how we can help. Stay tuned. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
I'm glad to be here. We've been trying to put this together for a while, and I'm glad we're finally getting to talk.
That's sweet too. Now, this podcast is all about working dogs in their various canine careers, and you've worked alongside dogs doing some crucially important work. Before we get into all that, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is John Norris in your own words?
Oh, wow. Put it in a nutshell. We'll just sum it up this way. I'm just a lifelong lover of the outdoor world and wildlife and waterways and wildlands, and been a conservationist, a hunter, and an angler, and a hiker since I was a kid. Was blessed to become a game warden in my early 20s, right out of college, and did a 28-year career as a fish and wildlife officer here in California, mostly in the Silicon Valley, but also in Southern California. And toward the end of my career, the last 15 years of my career were spent really in the special operations world of going after the drug cartel, illegal trespass, poison cannabis farm growers throughout all of the Golden State. And that was a very untraditional job that game wardens typically didn't do back in those days. But when we found out how environmentally damaging and how publicly dangerous these guys are to just our outdoor enthusiast safety of anyone in the woods, it kind of changed the game of what environmental crime threats we had in California. And we later learned throughout the rest of the nation as related to these drug cartels and these drug trafficking organizations out of Mexico. So I spent a lot of time doing that, developed the first specialized tactical unit called the Marijuana Enforcement Team for game wardens in California in 2013. And in that process, as you and I kind of met through the dog channel, got to work with some of the best, if not the best, apprehension, dual purpose canines I've ever had the privilege and blessing of being associated with and working with. And, you know, I've mentioned Canine Phoebe on other shows that I'm sure you've read about and heard about, but all of our dual purpose dogs are detection dogs, and how beneficial and crucial they are to operations like we do back on the California Fish and Wildlife Officer front, of not only keeping us alive against very dangerous criminals, but helping detect a lot of really damaging environmental crimes and solving those as well. And the blessings our canine partners are, they're indescribable.
So from a dog's perspective, if you were a dog and could speak English, how might you describe what a day on the job is like for you?
Well, I'm going to quote my good brother and fellow Met officer, Brian Boyd, when he talks about Canine Phoebe before she passed. She was affectionately known as the fur missile. And the term we used on the team a lot was, every time we went on a Met mission, things were going to get Western. And so if I'm Phoebe, I'm going to say, today I'm going to go to work, and I'm going to get really excited at about 3 a.m. in the dark when I see all these guys, like 20 or 30 officers in camouflage with their faces painted up, with all their battle kits on. And I'm going to get excited because I feel the energy of the danger of the mission we're about to go into. So I'm going to make my rounds and get to know every one of those officers and look them in the eye and let them know that I have their backs, that I know what they smell like, so I don't misidentify them when things get Western later and I might have to do some apprehension takedowns of some armed gunmen or armed cartel growers. And it's going to be a long day because I'm going to be hiking quietly and I'm going to be trying to stay real quiet with all the guys on my team. And I'm going to have to be really focused and honed and have my eyes alert, and especially that awesome nose I have that's so much better than a human's, to smell or detect an armed gunman ahead of us on a very densely wooded trail through creeks, through brush, through very noisy, kind of mountain brushy conditions. And I'm going to stop the problem. I'm going to save lives today. That's what I'm going to do. And my day, hopefully it ends in 10 to 12 hours, but I got a sneaky feeling like most Met missions, we're going to be out there from sunup to sundown, and it's going to be a really long, exhausting day, but it's going to be a good day because everyone's going to come home safe.
So you've mentioned drug cartels and you've mentioned things getting Western, but for listeners who might be like, what on earth is he talking about? Can you break down the massive problem that we're facing on our public lands involving the drug cartels right now? Because before I read your book or listened to you on a few other podcasts, I imagined that drug cartels basically were trafficking drugs across the border.
Right.
And I had no idea what was happening on this side of the border previous to drugs being in the form in which they could be smoked or inhaled or injected or whatnot.
Yeah. Basically, when I talk about drug cartels and it getting Western, I'm just talking about the one specific mission that was unique to Fish and Wildlife that our team specialized in. And that was going into these cannabis grow sites. And these are not legal, regulated, organically pure cannabis sites like we have through legitimate cannabis regulation now in California. These are ones that are on public or private lands, out in the forests, around very pristine waterways. And these are areas that can never be used for cannabis growing, but the cartels come in and trespass on them. And then they generate a grow complex of anywhere between 1,000 as high as 30 or 40,000 plants, and set up that complex for 6 to 9 months out of the year with kitchen areas and trash and living quarters, hundreds of thousands of pounds of fertilizer, EPA banned toxic poisons they use to put on the plants to keep rodents and animals and people off of their plants. But this stuff they put on the plants is so toxic and so dangerous. It was banned by the EPA 20 years ago from being used in agriculture here in America. But this is what they put on the plants, and they import it from Mexico because it's still available in third world countries outside of the U.S. For rodenticide, insecticide uses and things like that. So when I talk about that side of the mission, that is the particular criminal element we're going after from an environmental crime standpoint, because the waterways these guys destroy and poison when they have this toxically tainted water that they put onto the marijuana plants that they use to fortify the plants, all the grow poisons and pesticides and fertilizers that stay on the soil, all the habitat and cover and vegetation removal that they have to take off of hillsides above creeks to make room for their clandestine grow sites. That's a big environmental loss and habitat that puts a lot of siltation into the creeks. So these cartels are some of the biggest environmental criminals we have in the U.S. And that's what our marijuana enforcement team and our very highly trained and kind of specialized canines like Canine Phoebe and all the other dual-purpose Belgian Malinois apprehension detection dogs that we have on the force are trained to handle and trained to deal with, to detect, you know, human threats well before we run into them, and give us the best advantage possible to survive that mission or that conflict that day and go home safely. Phoebe basically, and the other dual purpose dogs like her, their job is to keep us as safe as possible and execute and be successful on the mission as efficiently and safely as possible. And what I mean by that is she will not only bite apprehend an armed and dangerous grower that's pulling, say, an AK-47 rifle on us or on the dogs, or pulling a knife or trying to do deadly force harm to not only our canines, but any of the human team members. But her excellent nose is honed to smell cannabis, to detect those EPA banned grow poisons. So she is alerting onto grow sites as we're getting half quarter mile away and able to smell the threat up ahead and alert us that we're getting close. And even though most of the time we know the exact location, she's an added warning sign, if you will, like an early detection system of, you know, any armed growers that might be on the trail ahead of us, not in the grow yet, or somewhere in the forest close to us. She basically, and the dogs like her, just keep us most aware and safest as possible to finish the mission effectively that day.
Is there a particular story that comes to mind that you could share about what one of your dogs did to save the day?
Yeah, I think about the second chapter of Hidden War in my latest book, and it was a 2012 mission. And the reason it was included in Hidden War, because Hidden War covers 6 years of how MET was developed, you know, the political and the, you know, traditional kind of frame of references and mindset of what game wardens should and shouldn't do, kind of the internal and external struggles we had politically to form a team like that, but why it was so necessary and why it became so effective. And when I wrote Hidden War, I really wrote Hidden War to educate not only the public, but other law enforcement agencies and other conservation and regulatory agencies to understand the depth of the problem out there and understand the dangers. Our team, Shane, has been involved in 6 gunfights since 2005, the first of which my young game warden partner was shot through both legs by an AK-47 and almost died on the hill before we got him air rescued. And that changed the game for me as a game warden and all of my colleagues, not only in Fish and Game, but other law enforcement agencies like the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office that day, as to what new threat we were dealing with environmentally and what public safety threat we had in our hills. And in 2012, we didn't have a Met team formed yet, but I was able to borrow Warden Boyd and Canine Phoebe and bring them down to Santa Clara County, my home county in the Silicon Valley, where I was working hand in hand with the sheriff's marijuana eradication team. And they didn't have canines yet. Very few agencies did. And Phoebe was already doing amazing work up in Shasta County. She had been highlighted on our, you know, our hit reality TV show, the first Game Warden reality TV show, Wild Justice on National Geographic. So she was a well-known dog nationally, and especially on the West Coast, with what Brian and her had become as an effective, you know, kind of cartel apprehension team up in Northern California. And on that mission that day, I was Brian's canine cover officer, which means I was handgun armed, right on Brian's tail, covering him and Phoebe in the event we had a bite apprehension or we had any weapons pulled on us, to make sure that he was not vulnerable in the process of executing an arrest and handling his dog during an apprehension bite. And the way it worked out that day is we had two armed cartel growers, both with weapons, both with handguns, walking toward us, unaware we were there. And one started to pull a handgun, and we had to release the dog to apprehend that suspect. So Phoebe, the fur missile, is going for this one suspect that's got a gun. And then we see a gun in a holster coming out of a holster of a second suspect. So we were just kind of overwhelmed. So Brian and I were running after these suspects, following Phoebe, who now has one of the armed suspects on the ground with a bite to his calf, keeping him on the ground, and unbeknownst to us, keeping him from pulling or slowing him down from pulling another automatic pistol from his waistband that he was going to direct right towards me and Brian and the other guys. So Brian has to handle an armed suspect hand to hand. I have to deal with Phoebe, who's now in a full bite apprehension on another armed suspect. And as I'm struggling with that suspect that Phoebe's helping me contain, right when I get onto him to put him into custody, I see this gun come out of his waistband and he's starting to turn it on me. And I was able to subdue the suspect enough that he couldn't shoot the gun. But nobody got hurt from the standpoint of having to fire a weapon. I didn't have to use my weapon on that suspect. He didn't get a shot off at me or any of the riflemen backing me up. And that was a day that Phoebe literally saved my life and saved the life of about 10 other operators on that team. And had it not been for her getting on that suspect quickly and making that bite, I would have been in a gunfight exchange of about 5 feet. And there's no way I come out of that unscathed. And yeah, so that kind of changed the game for me. And when we had that whole grow site kind of safe, and we had those guys in handcuffs, and we were now dealing with 7,000 toxic marijuana plants with the EPA banned carbofuran poison all over it, and we had a steelhead channel and a really pristine waterway, very close, right above the headwaters above the hometown of Morgan Hill, California, where I grew up. I was on the phone to both chiefs, both Nancy Foley, who ran our agency as the number one badge, our chief of patrol, and then my mentor and good friend, Mike Carrion, who was at the time the assistant chief of the Northern California district that basically, you know, was the commander in chief, if you will, of Brian's district. And it was his graciousness that allowed Brian and Phoebe to come down out of their normal working area and be on that mission that day. But the best part of that was, it was a great example of how important good canines are for this type of mission. And I had a compelling conversation with both of my chiefs, both Nancy and Mike, that day from the grow site. I said, it was a real close call. We're not calling you down for an officer-involved shooting, which is just really stressful. And, you know, I mean, it's just the chaos that happens after a shooting, logistically with staff and all the follow-up is just so horrible, not to mention, I mean, and that's secondary, of course, to any of the physical harm that just is inevitable in an officer-involved shooting. But I stressed in that conversation, we need Phoebe or more dogs like her on every single cartel trespass grow mission. We're absolutely not doing it safely if we do it any lesser way, which up until that point, we did it all the time without dogs because we just didn't have dogs and the job had to get done. And they agreed. And that moment changed my life. You know, it bonded me with Phoebe even more. And when she passed away, when we lost her of leukemia at 13 years old, in 2018, it was a heartbreaking moment. It was just, you know, just absolutely falling in love with Phoebe on so many levels. And she was so friendly and so playful and so social for being such a honed apprehension dog that she could literally flip a switch and change modes of mindset instantly. But she was just a great hearted dog and she loved working. And she wasn't the biggest Mal. She didn't have the biggest bite pressure, but she had the biggest heart I've ever seen out there of a good apprehension dog. And that's why I included it at the beginning of the book to show how important she was and how important she was when we developed our marijuana enforcement team and made it so specialized. We really worked a lot of our ground tactics around Phoebe and any other dog that would have to perform up to her level that would come after and around her. But that was definitely a mission that stands out. And there's about 20 plus others where she saved my life and the lives of all the guys. And that's probably a conservative estimate. It was much more than that. But that was a historical game changer and it helped justify us having a specialized team that was historical and never been done in the country before for that type of operation, especially for game wardens. And we are just really blessed that it worked out the way it did. And we got to build the team we've got now because through COVID and through changing border policy, the cartels have gone there. They have, you know, just gone ballistic on steroids, for lack of a better pun. They're going crazy right now in America, and the California forests are under siege, and there's very few law enforcement teams and dog teams that are effective out there trying to stop it. And our team still is. I just trained with my old Met brothers and allied agencies just this last week, and got to see some of our newer dogs in action that have replaced Phoebe and ones that were just starting out when I retired. And it was just heartwarming to see that we're still putting up the fight. We're still trying to hold back the tide, but it's a huge problem that's not going away, and dogs are going to continue to save the day in this process.
After reading your book, my takeaways from what's going on are that the cartels are poisoning our plants, and then therefore the wildlife, and also the final product, which people around the country are using. Like, they think they're getting marijuana and they're getting some poisoned version of it, and they're diverting our waterways. So they're diverting water away from what it should be used for to grow these plants. And I live in California, and there was such a hard push to conserve water, and we did a pretty good job of it. And meanwhile, they're stealing water from us. And then also, if you enjoy the outdoors, so like I'm going backpacking this summer, am I going to have to worry about stumbling upon one of these grows to my own peril?
Yeah, and that's a really good point you bring up, is this is something that outdoor enthusiasts everywhere could run across. And, you know, I don't ever want to put a panic switch up and say, you know, you shouldn't backpack, watch where you go. Situational awareness and just being careful where you're going and realizing that anywhere where there's a water source in the pristine mountains of California, there could be a grow site. 9 times out of 10, you know, in big public trail areas and national parks on the heavily used areas, we don't see them a lot there. It's not that they're not there or they couldn't be, but very rarely do we see a presence. It's one of those things you just got to be careful of. And you said it best, do I have to worry that I'm going to run across one of these grow sites to my peril? And I think the thing is, just knowledge is power, and having the awareness after reading Hidden War, you kind of know what to look for, you know, the topography, you know, where some of these were located throughout the state. And one thing we tried to do, because this is a national problem, Shane, it's not just California. I mean, there's clandestine cartel grow sites being done in 25 other states to a lesser extent, because, you know, there's not another true Mediterranean climate state like California in the U.S. I mean, we are one of 6 true Mediterranean climates in the world. And that's what makes California such a good agriculture or good cannabis state, is because of our climate. We are the bulk of it. And knowing that, we're just going to have more of it here. So, you know, those of us that like to hike, like to backpack, like to mountain bike, hunt, fish, or whatever, in on national, you know, on public lands, could potentially run across a growth site or see signs of it. And the best thing to do is just be aware, understand what those visual signs look like. And if you run into a black water hose or a weird camp somewhere that it doesn't belong, or you see, you know, individuals out there that don't look like hikers or backpackers or anybody else doing legitimate recreational activity, best to just document where you're at, get a photo, get a GPS coordinate if you can off your phone or your device, and just move out of there and report it. And don't get pushed out of the mountains where you don't want to go, you know, enjoy Mother Nature and all the beauty she has to, you know, to just reward all of us. I mean, it's such a treat to be out there. Just know that, you know, you may have to leave a particular area if it's got grow activity in it, and kind of move base, if you will, change your camp plan of where you're going to go from there.
Because there have been a few instances where hikers have run into these situations.
Yeah, there's been more than a few. The people that find these besides us on the law enforcement side are people like yourself, you know, that love the outdoors, that spend some time hiking or backpacking. A lot of, you know, ethical and legal hunters and anglers are our biggest finders of cartel grow sites, because hunters and anglers don't stick to just normal, regular public trails. They want to get down on waterways to see where the animals are. They might want to get to a fishing spot. So they're going cross country a little bit, or they're going into the more remote, rugged areas. And that's typically where these grow sites, or at least the water diversion for these grow sites, start. It starts up at these pristine headwaters to big streams and lakes and rivers that are much lower in elevation. And they start diverting water right there from the source immediately at the tail end of winter. So you guys find these, the hunters and anglers find these, the, you know, mountaineering folks that get off the beaten path to find a nice approach or a nice rock, find these. And if it, honestly, you guys are our best informants through the CalTIP program, turn in a poacher, to put, you know, to make that call and let us know what's going on and where you don't want to be recreating, because of what you just found. And you definitely don't want other people going in there behind you until we can go in and clear it out. So yeah, it is found by outdoor enthusiasts a predominant amount of time.
So you mentioned the CalTIP program. What is that?
CalTIP is a turn-in poacher hotline, and every state has one with their fish and wildlife, their conservation officer group. For us, it's 1-800-CALTIP, spelled with a CALTIP, 1-800-CALTIP. And every hunter or angler on their hunting license or fishing license, that number is on there, but it's not restricted to just hunting and fishing use. Anybody can call CALTIP if they see an environmental criminal going on. And it's a 24-hour hotline that we monitor through our dispatch center out of Sacramento. And if you can't get a hold of a local warden, because wardens are few and far between, especially in the busy times when we got to be in the mountains, somebody will get that tip and call you back or follow up or forward the information where they need to related to that turn in a poacher hotline. And the thing that's interesting about it is, I talk a little bit about this when people ask, well, turning in a poacher is kind of like turning in somebody taking too many fish, or taking, you know, a deer out of season, or, you know, an environmental polluter, or things like that. Well, why would we call about marijuana? And for all those reasons we've just talked about, these are the biggest polluters and some of the biggest environmental criminals we have now in the state. So the last 2 years operationally before I retired, of all the CalTIP reports we would get, of all the CalTIPs that were coming into the agency, I think in 2017 or 2018, one of those last couple of years I was here, 70 or 80% of the CalTIPs were all cannabis related. They weren't even traditional poaching crimes. And that just tells you of the tone of the state of where we were going and how much people were outraged by not only the cartels and what they were doing on public lands, but by some of these private land growers that were destroying creeks next to neighbors, taking water illegally and, you know, allowing no more water for their neighbors for agriculture or for drinking or things like that. So it's become a big problem on not only the environmental crime front and the public safety front, but the water conservation front. And as you know, from being a California native, what we both share, you know, a great time living here in the Golden State, from about 2013-14 up to about 2017, we were in the state's worst drought that California's seen in a century. And we were seeing so much water already in low amounts being stolen by the cartels for trespass grow activity. It got Governor Brown's attention at the time. It brought in funding to form up our watershed enforcement teams, which, you know, really do the bulk of private land, quasi-legitimate cannabis compliance, cannabis cultivation compliance in the state now. That was all funded because of the drought, because when environmental scientists were able to quantify that 1.3 billion gallons of water, that's a conservative estimate, 1.3 billion gallons of water were taken from California residents, from our California forests and our waterways, and stolen by the cartels to grow tainted marijuana. That blew everybody's mind. That's a lot of water, especially in a year when, you know, water was so depleted in the high lakes and in the, you know, pristine streams and what we would call traditional annual streams that were just bone dry for the better part of 3 or 4 years. So we have the water loss, and we have, you know, California on the fringe of another drought right now in 2021. You know, riding around with ranchers and back in my old haunts, being here in California for some good work. Currently, just it blows my mind to see how much these grow sites are still impacting our water amounts, and how sensitive California is going into another drought.
So infuriating. And are these cartels are from Mexico mostly?
They are. Yeah, now we certainly have different criminal factions. We have Russian gangs, and we have some of the Asian gang groups and organized crime groups working in and around Northern California and other parts of the country. But the vast majority, and I'm going to say 90%+, come from Central Mexican cartels that are both operating down in Mexico, and then they're also embedded throughout America, not just in California. And something we want to remember about these cartel groups, obviously we're focusing on, you know, this toxically tainted, trespass, poisoned cannabis for the black market that these cartels put out there, largely because we're focusing on the environmental impacts. We're focused on the public safety impacts these type of criminals, you know, kind of engender being out in our forests. But these same criminal groups are responsible for the human and child and sex trafficking rings going on all over the country. In all 50 states, that's just another segment of what they do. They're responsible for methamphetamine production out of dirty labs, not only in Mexico, but dirty lab cooks here in America, to put out a very, you know, destructive methamphetamine narcotic. Fentanyl, the synthetic heroin that's coming out of dirty labs in Mexico and starting to be produced up here in the lower 48 of the U.S., same cartels that are doing tainted weed. And some of the black market copycat prescription opioids that are made in dirty labs, where one pill could look like a legitimate pharmaceutical prescribed pill and do what it's intended to do. And the next pill could be so weird on dose with so many byproducts in it that you're dead within seconds when you ingest it. We're starting to see that too. And that's some stuff that's coming out of the Drug Enforcement Administration's intel and the stuff they work all over the country related to cartel activity north and south of the border. So we're dealing with a criminal element, unfortunately, that's pervasive in all levels of hurting humanity. I don't know any other way to term it, on all these different type of crimes. But on the environmental crime front, the one that impacts the worst certainly is the tainted weed or the toxically tainted cannabis that we see in all the trespass grow sites in California and about half the rest of the country.
So what can we do besides alerting the CalTIP or whatever state you're in, if you happen to be out and about and you see something? What can we do just as the general public to help curb this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I appreciate you asking that, because the biggest thing is knowledge. When people know about this and they report on it, or they, you know, talk about it on social media, when they push legislatures to find more reclamation cleanup bills, to put more enforcement out there, to make it more of a priority, all of those things are good. And that's what we can do as public members of Stewards of the Outdoors, is be an extension of the Thin Green Line. I think you've heard me talk about this on other shows. My whole brand, if you will, post-retirement is the Thin Green Line for the country. And the Thin Green Line isn't just game wardens. It's not just border control agents. It's not just military. It's not just conservation officers and law enforcement out there fighting the fight head on. It's you, it's your friends, it's fellow people that just, you know, love the outdoors, love canines, and just want to see our America public and private lands safe and healthy and sustainable, so we have it for many more generations to enjoy, and we can go out there and enjoy it safely. So reporting a grow site, talking about it with your friends, sharing, you know, information on social media, joining good foundations, good conservation agencies that are trying to do something with this. I'm an advisory board member of a new advisory group that popped up about 2 years ago, and they were formed strictly to help educate and to help find additional funds to reclimate and clean up these grow sites, which law enforcement agencies like my old agency don't necessarily have enough money or enough time to get them all. And the group is called CROP, Cannabis Removal on Public Lands. And people can volunteer, they can donate money toward the cause, they can help spread the word of stuff we're working directly with our state and federal legislatures to get bills passed that are going to fund this effort more effectively, not only in California, but the rest of the country as well. Every little bit helps. And I think one of the other things is to really be aware and not to necessarily plug not to plug Hidden War or War in the Woods or any of my books, but those are two references, especially Hidden War, that really lays out visually with all the pictures and historically the depth of the problem. And then you get into the appendices section of Hidden War, and you get into the science. You get into the environmental crime damages of what these EPA banned poisons do, that they're a nerve agent, that they're an anticoagulant, that some of the active ingredients in these poisons were, you know, developed by the Nazis for their bioweapons back in World War II. That's how nasty this stuff is. And when you look at some of the scientific appendices chapters, kind of the analyticals, if you will, in the book, you find out from our scientific crews out there doing the studies and the samples what this stuff does long-term in a grow site, not just when it's deposited on a plant or when it's put in a waterway that plant is using. What does it do in the soil for the next 3 to 5 years if it's not cleaned up, if that grow site isn't reclimated, if that stuff isn't removed? What does it do to 3, 4, 5 generations of animals and to our water that's working its way downstream and going into drinking water sources and treatment plants and fish and big game and other mammals? You know, it's just an endless cycle of destruction if we don't get aware and we don't push to get more effort to stop it out there.
Listeners, we're currently trying to determine the future of this show, and we would really appreciate your feedback. If you have a moment, we'd really appreciate it if you'd fill out our listener feedback survey. You can find a link to it in the show notes, or if you go to herobeside.me, click on the podcast button, you'll see a listener feedback survey button at the top of that next page. It only takes about 2 minutes to complete, and we would really appreciate it. Thanks so much. Back to the show. What sort of hazards are these dogs facing? You mentioned something about someone pulling a knife on a dog. And then I imagine if they're trained to detect these poisons, so that means they're coming in contact with the poisons.
Yeah, the poisons are certainly a threat to the dogs. And something we do now, we kind of put our dogs through protective protocol just like we do ourselves. We don't let them get near plants. We especially a tainted, you know, grow site that has really recently tainted marijuana plants. And when you see a white sheen that looks like kind of a white clear liquid or like a clear coat paint or bird poop or like little blotches of liquid paper, on the flower, the bud material, or any part of the plant, that means it's been treated within the last couple of days and it's most toxic. On grows like that, we'll go in and assess it. We may not even eradicate a plant, and we're definitely not going to have our dogs anywhere near those plants. The other thing we do now is once we secure the grow site and basically make sure there are no armed suspects in it, take them into custody or find it abandoned or whatever we need to do, and the dogs have done everything they can do to make the day safe and everybody's safe and we know we don't have any more threats, we'll keep our dogs in a very safe area where they're not going to encounter chemicals. They're not going to be on contaminated areas. We have them blood tested just like we do, numerous blood tests throughout the year to look for that element. If it's got into our bloodstream through lead blood testing, we use, protective gear like nitrile gloves. We're even looking at actual paw protectors that have nitrile. So just like human hands and skin, they can't absorb anything from the ground. But we're very careful when we go into these sites, and we do suspect we have lost some of our dogs to toxic exposure to these chemicals. We can't prove it because they dilute in the system so quickly. But besides that, the other threats are what you just mentioned, Shayna, are impact weapons, everything from hammers to rocks to sticks that these growers will strike our dogs with because, they're kind of fighting them to the death because they know getting caught is going to be a big, bad thing for them. Being shot, we have had canines that have been shot in grow sites. It's a horrible tragedy, and it doesn't happen a lot because usually we get the jump on the suspect before that can happen, but it's a dangerous, imprecise science, if you will, and it doesn't always go as planned. The other thing is stabbings. We've started to see a lot more fixed blade knives and, deer bones that are honed and sharpened and taped up with handles to actually be used just to stab canines as they're biting a suspect.
Good grief.
It's intense. And I talk about this in Hidden War as well, where our dogs were getting so effective at taking out so many good growers. And every time, we interdict a grow site, I mean, that's for the cartel's black market profit. That's a loss of anywhere from $2 to $50 million. It's a lot of money they're losing when we, one, find a grow site. But imagine the impact when one of our dogs has to bite apprehend an armed grower that's a really good grower. He's a vetted journeyman, trained in Mexico, and he's not necessarily good in just one grow. He might have set up 10 or 20 grows, and he's just working at a particular grow site right now. And all of a sudden, he's taken out permanently, or at least for the whole season, through apprehension injury and being in custody, whether he's deported or not. That dog has cost that cartel millions of dollars. So pretty soon, our dogs, Phoebe and others I won't name for the safety of the dogs, they start getting well known, and the word is out in those cartel circles. This is what we're going to do, guys. We're going to change tactics. We're going to suck these dogs in because we know they're going to be, they're going to have a distance from their handler on the apprehension, on the rundown, and we're going to bring them in, and we're going to stab them in the neck and the jugular, or we're going to stab them, in the heart. Up around the first, between the first and second rib. They have honed these tactics, and they've actually stabbed quite a few dogs, a couple of federal agency dogs fatally, unfortunately, and some others that I have a picture of in Hidden War, and I talk on PowerPoints I speak to all over the country on this stuff, of one of our really good dogs that was stabbed near fatally but made a full recovery and is back out doing great work. And a dog that got to work with Phoebe a lot when he was a young pup. And those are beautiful personal memory days of mine of watching Phoebe and this federal dog work together and just do beautiful work together. And it's so good that he survived. But there are some dogs that didn't. And certainly our tactics and our allied agency tactics on how we deploy our dogs are constantly evolving to the conditions we face. So knowing that these dogs are targeted, we are very careful on how our dogs deploy, how we can cover our dogs quickly, and knock on wood, thus far, since those heavy stabbing incidences and the loss of dogs from cartel stabbings in 2016, 2017, and I think even some in 2018, we haven't had too many more, if any, that I'm aware of. But But yeah, that is a big threat to our dogs because they're breaking the back of these criminal enterprises, and they're, you know, not only saving lives, but they're saving a lot of environment.
Do they wear any kind of protective gear?
Well, they do when they can. There are great ballistic vest systems for canines. The only problem is when you're working in 100, 110 degree heat on long hikes and you put a vest on that heavy, and not necessarily heavy in weight, but heavy in protective, you know, ballistic protection, they don't insulate really well. They don't breathe very well. And so same thing us human guys and gals got to deal with how much armor do we wear into a grow on a 110 degree day? And yeah, we can, you know, pretty much stop a tank round from hitting us, but are we going to go down from heat exhaustion or heat stroke before that, or dehydration? And for dogs that, you know, pant and breathe and their heart rate's up all day long, especially a dual purpose dog, it's a real fine line between what armor they can wear or not on mission day. But yes, we do have protective armor for the dogs, and it's getting better every year with technology. And we're very blessed to have really the best of the best equipment out there. A lot of our equipment is, you know, synonymous to what special operations group like the SEALs and Delta teams use with their canines on the military front, because we do a very similar job on a domestic front. And we have dogs that are from those same breeders that are trained to that level and that are just, you know, such an investment in time, heart, and money to get the dogs to the level they need to be effective to do that job. We want to protect them as best we can, just like our human operators. And they are treated as good as our human operators, as they should be, because they're just another, you know, very much loved member of the team, four legs versus two.
It's so crazy that you actually have to protect their identity.
We do. Yeah. And it's one of those things that, rather to be safe than sorry, the last thing I want to do is put out a name of a canine that's, you know, approaching bite numbers like Phoebe had. I mean, Phoebe had 116 bite apprehensions in her career, and she had another 900 apprehensions where the suspects gave up and she didn't have to bite. And those were just the cartel suspects she caught. So that's over 1,000 arrests on some of the most violent internationally known criminals. So a dog like that put so much hurt on that criminal organization and did so much good work to stop what they were doing and protect so many public members that those armed gunmen may have hurt in another situation or another scenario had Phoebe not been there to make that arrest. I mean, that's mind-boggling. Now, granted, that's crazy high numbers for any canine, but let's take another good canine that's got 30 or 50 bites and is still out there working and is 6 or 7 years old and has a lot of you know, service life left in him. If that dog's name is known and that dog is identifiable, that's not a good thing. I mean, they're going to target any dog they run across, but I mean, imagine, you know, the kudos they would get for getting that one super dog that's kind of getting really good at wrecking lives on the black market criminal cartel side. So, yeah, we want to keep our dogs as safe as everybody else, and hence the protection there.
How do they practice?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's extensive repetitive practice. And one, getting that trust and that bond between the handler and the canine. And then, you know, getting out of basic canine school where they're certified to detect, they're certified to bite apprehend. But after that, it's just like our operators on firearms or defensive tactics or hand to hand. We constantly drill, we constantly rehearse, and you just do it so much and you get so fluid at it that, you know, you don't practice. You get to a point where you don't practice to get it right anymore. You practice so you can't do it wrong. You know, you've trained so much that you will not get it wrong. You will execute the tactic, the shooting drill, the movement, the takedown, the bite deployment, the silence in the woods, the quiet stalking, how to read your other officers. If you're a canine, you know, 18 inches above the ground with those, you know, those laser beam of eyes, you'll just never get it wrong. And Phoebe became that dog. Phoebe was the dog that never bit an officer by mistake, and never gave up on getting a suspect, even on a long run, and only lost a suspect when she had been hit in the head with a rock, hit over the head with a pan, concussed a couple of times, and she still wouldn't want to give up until we finally she had to stop because it, you know, she, there were some catches she just wasn't going to make. And after experiencing things like that, that you can't control sometimes, that's when the tactics and the leash training and everything else starts to change. So our dogs aren't exposed to that. But yeah, our canine handlers, I'm going to use Brian Boyd for an example. When he's not on a mission, when he's not on a scout, when he's not talking to a room of school kids or presenting like all of us on Met do for outreach and education, especially with our dogs, because people really resonate with seeing our dogs in action, even in demos and displays for public relations. He's out with a ball, with a Kong biter or anything else. And we're working drills, reward, detection drills, you know, getting our guys in bite suits, setting up growth scenarios at training when we train collectively a couple times a month as a tactical unit. And then our canine handlers have all that training gear in their truck, so they can be back in the forest somewhere and get another savvy canine trained officer and say, hey, do you want to be in my bite suit? Do you want to be a bad guy? And we're going to do some bite scenarios right now. And we're going to switch it up with different type of cover, putting it on an uphill slope with leaf litter on the ground. So it's loud, it's slippery, downhill, uphill, in a creek, brushy conditions, and just basically practicing in an environment that looks and mirrors exactly what we're going to see in a real cartel grow site takedown. And we've just done it so much that as soon as we deploy, it's just another mission. It's just another training drill, and we don't get it wrong. And that's the level the canines need to be at to go out and do this job. And there's a lot of new teams starting up, and we're helping those teams. We were just last week, we were merged up with the California State Parks Cannabis Special Enforcement Team. And they've been formed up with cannabis funding because cartel grows are all over state parks. So we're working hand in hand with them, and we're working with their canine teams. And, you know, they're very new and they're very motivated, and they're a great group of guys. But they're going through the same growing pains we did back in the day when we started. And we fortunately can come in and say, hey, I'll save you 3 years of learning lessons and failing forward with what we didn't do right, and we can try this. And we just want to see every team get to that level. And this is a team that's striving to do that, just like any other canine team should be out there, because the cartel element is a whole different level, I think, when it comes to, if that's your typical criminal client you're dealing with daily, then you got to have the best of the best training.
How do you teach a dog to be silent in the woods?
It's hard. Some dogs just naturally have it, and some dogs, you know, they got to learn it. Smaller dogs, typically, like, you know, Phoebe was a 70-pound female Belgian male, and our newer dogs, without giving away trade secrets, are all different sizes. We have all kinds of different size dogs. But what I can say is the smaller dogs tend to glide around a little quieter. If they have good ball drive, good pursuit drive, but it's not overly powering, then they can stay silent for hours. Phoebe was that kind of dog, and our current dogs are just that way. If they see a suspect out there that we got to watch for a long time, that you're not going to necessarily buy it, you don't know if they're armed, you don't know how they're going to react, we're very careful and very select on when we deploy an apprehension dog and when we don't. We only do it when there is a real threat to immediate bodily injury or death to us or partners or other officers. It's basically a deadly force situation right now these days, most of the time. There are other circumstances where our dogs can engage on a bite, but they're very select. And now the biggest thing is, if we keep them quiet, we can neutralize a lot of violence, because we can probably get in closer and have a less violent encounter to safely get suspects into custody and not have to use any weapons or tools, including the dog. But it's a long process, and it's a lot of practice and training. It's a lot of talking, communication between the handler and the dog, and setting up scenarios where they see a suspect out there that they think they're going to bite, especially in bite suit training, and having them out there for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe an hour and a half, but he's never done anything that warrants a bite. There's nothing violent. And having that dog sit there with all that drive that they've been trained to execute, and not whimper, not bark, not yelp. It's very hard with new dogs, but it just takes time. And eventually, we have not had a dog yet that couldn't get to the point where they could stay super silent. No matter how excited they were, they're going to stay silent and they're going to stay controlled. They're going to stay disciplined, we call it. And when it's time to deploy, if they need to deploy for a bite, they will. But 9 times out of 10, they're not going to deploy because we're just not going to be doing bite apprehensions unless we absolutely have to. So these are going to be some unrewarded dogs a lot of the time, and they have to get used to that letdown through ball work and, different rewards and praise, actually in the grow site on a mission. And then certainly in training to mimic similar training where they're not going to get an apprehension, but they're going to get a lot of love and thanks from the handler and the rest of the team.
So final question.
Okay.
How has working with dogs impacted you personally, other than the fact that it's literally saved your life? But I mean, on an emotional, intellectual level.
Yeah, that's never been asked. It's a beautiful question. Thank you for asking it. And I've been a dog person since birth. I've had labs my whole life. You know, we were waterfowl hunters, so we had the whole waterfowl dog thing going. And Apollo was my first companion canine in the agency. I'm sorry, Jordan. And she died of cancer in 2010. And Apollo, who there's photographs of Apollo in her puppy years in Hidmore, who actually went out on her first grow scout. And she was actually instrumental in detecting suspects ahead so we didn't walk into them on that very mission that Phoebe saved my life on 4 months later. It was actually that site that I was scouting with 2 sheriff's deputies. It was the youngest dog to ever do that. So she definitely was bright. And it warmed my heart when she started to alert on smelling cannabis up ahead, which told us we had a grow up ahead. And sure enough, there were growers setting up that grow in like late February, but it was only 3 officers and 1 little canine that wasn't a bite canine. Because as you know, our labs aren't going to bite any cartel member. They're going to try to, do a diplomatic compromise and mediate and lick them to death at best. But but they still do great work. And Apollo is that dog. And long-windedly, what I'm explaining is dogs are family. They're my kids. You know, I don't have kids of my own. I work with kids all over the world and through mentorships and conservation stuff. But the closest thing I've had to children of my own are these dogs, first Jordan and then Apollo. And then the third child I kind of felt like I had, like I was, I don't know, uncle, almost an uncle being the team leader and loving my brother Brian Boyd like a brother that he is and a great friend as well as a great teammate, was falling in love with Phoebe. I mean, that dog just melts hearts. And when I can have a bite dog, an apprehension dog, that is so skilled tactically and have the historic career she had, I mean, she was recognized with her own resolution recognition award in the assembly in 2017 just for her and what she did in the cannabis enforcement world. And that was the first time a canine had been recognized in the Senate from our agency, or in our Capitol for anything like that, and our Met team as well. And that was not only a huge honor, but it just showed you the depth of heart that this dog had above and beyond being a fur missile. She was as friendly as Apollo. She played with my yellow lab. They went out and ran circles around, the sheriff's range, hip checking, wrestling, knocking each other over, licking each other. Just 2 girl dogs having a great day. And, Phoebe was the kind of dog that when you weren't on mission time, she'd get up on her back, rub her back, want belly scratches, look at you with those, those puppy eyes. And you just couldn't help but love the Phoebes, she's just a beautiful soul. And that very nature of what dogs are, both on and off duty, they've just impacted me in a way that just give me a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of hope for the job we do, because it's very easy to get pessimistic. It's very easy to get hopeless in this battle because it's not slowing down. It's increasing. What's happening in this country from the cartels, it's an absolute heartbreak on everything from the human and sex and children's trafficking side to the tainted, poison cannabis production side and to the decimation in the forest. But these dogs keep us motivated. And they inspire us. And both of my labs and Phoebe included and all our other dogs that are on the team now that I'm still very blessed to go be around and train with periodically, they just give me hope. They bring joy instead of despair. You know, when you look at the mission we do, and they keep it important. They keep it feeling very relevant, and we feel like we're doing something that needs to be done out there. And we encourage more teams to do the same. And you know, just bring your canines up and treat them as the best family and friends you've got, and keep them safe. And they're going to keep you safe. And you can't help but fall in love with that.
What is it about them that makes them so inspiring and such good work partners, do you think?
It's really boils down to two things. Unconditional love, because they will sacrifice and work relentlessly under any circumstances. Even if they're hurt, they'll still put themselves above you because they always want to protect you. You can be having your saddest day and they'll always bring you up. They'll always bring you up, because when they're getting their butts kicked, when they're hot and tired and sweaty, when they're getting beat on by a cartel hammer or a stick in a grow, or worse yet, you know, a honed, sharpened, you know, black-tailed deer shank designed to stab them in the jugular, they'll take hits and they'll just look at you with those sad and happy eyes and just tell you, "I'm not out of the fight. I've got you. I've got you. I've got you." And they're selfless. They're always selfless. And we can't say that about everybody we're around on the human front, but that's why we do it. And that's why we connect so much with those dogs. And that's why it hurts so much when they get hurt. And that's why it feels so good when they have a victory, because it's everybody's victory. But they did the heavy lifting. They made the biggest sacrifice that day. And how can you not love that? And how can you not be inspired to not lose your confidence and lose your hope to continue to do what we need to do, because no one else is going to do it. And we can't let this country, we can't let our wildlife, our wildlands, and our waterways fall into the hands and be destroyed by and eroded by, you know, really a foreign eco-terrorist, for lack of a better, you know, term, that don't care about our wildlife. They don't care about our waterways. They don't care about purity, the pristine nature of it, protecting it. And certainly don't care about humanity, but our dogs sure care about our humanity and keeping us safe. And that's why we love them so much.
Well, is there anything I didn't ask that you...
No. I think you covered some great questions. I'm super happy that we got to finally have this conversation. Grateful to share all this with you. Certainly want your listeners to know, if you have any questions or any interest in learning more about this, or want access to the books or any of the, I host two podcasts myself, as I think you're aware of. The Thin Green Line, I co-host it with retired Lieutenant Wayne Saunders of conservation officer in New Hampshire, and also Warden's Watch, which is game warden stories, pretty much exclusively from game wardens. But the Thin Green Line is a podcast where we talk to anybody Thin Green Line related, not even necessarily law enforcement. We've had canine folks, canine trainers outside of law enforcement, as an example. Tune into that, guys, to hear more on the Thin Green Line and all these issues, because we're always talking about the hottest topics, not only what we've talked about today. And then if you want to get a hold of me and you have any questions about canine training, becoming a conservation officer, working into something like a MET team, you can reach me through my website, and it's just johnnorris.com, johnnorris.com. And I'm the same handle on Instagram, johnnorris, and Facebook. And you can direct message me or follow me there for the latest updates on stuff like this, when the next podcast is coming out, or what we've talked about, or what training events are coming up. Because I still teach and train and speak all over the country, and have the privilege, you know, of getting to talk about this like we're talking about today. So I'm just real grateful we get to share this. And thanks for some great questions today. It's been great.
We'll have the links to your books, podcasts, your website, and the crops thing you mentioned in the show notes.
That would be awesome. Greatly appreciated. And thank you so much.
Thanks for being on the show. Thank you for listening to the show today. If you enjoyed it, please consider subscribing on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or a number of other platforms. As I mentioned earlier, I'm your host, Shauna T. I'm a professional photographer, and I'm currently working on a photography project about working dogs. If you would like information about this project, please visit herobeside.me and sign up for the newsletter. Again, that's herobeside.me. Thanks so much. See you next time.